Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the Hockey Podcast Network. Your home for hockey talk covering every team in the NHL. New episodes every Monday. Download at thehockeypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get your podcasts from.
This is the Leaf Sky Podcast. Here's your host, Jim Taddy.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to episode number 34 of Leaf Sky. Jim Taddy with you. We've got a long show today, about 40 minutes worth. Nice conversation with former Leaf Gary Lehman. And we welcome into the Leaf Sky podcast for the first time David Alter from the Hockey News as he updates us on the Leafs as they get set to conclude their Montreal part of the regular season with a game at home to the Habs on Saturday night. Before we get there, the hits literally keep on coming from one boxing event to the next. They grow in excitement and anticipation. And this weekend is no different with two of the sport's most respected fighters stepping into the ring Saturday night. There is no better place to get in on all the action than the DraftKings Sportsbook, America's top-rated sportsbook app. For this weekend's fight, DraftKings is offering all new users a shot at turning $1 into $55. To celebrate this weekend's huge event, DraftKings Sportsbook offering new users the opportunity to get 55-1 odds on either main event fighter to win this weekend's fight. That's $1, and if the fighter of your choice wins, you win $55. Plus, with basketball and hockey playoffs right around the corner, DraftKings Sportsbook has even more ways for you to make it rain. DraftKings Sportsbook is safe, secure, and reliable, meaning you can deposit and withdraw your funds at your convenience. So, ladies and gentlemen, here's the call to action. Download the top-rated DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use the code THPN when you sign up. For a limited time, all new users can bet $1 to win $55 on this weekend's main event. That's right. DraftKings Sportsbook is going all out for new users by offering them the chance to win $55 when placing a bet of $1 on this weekend's big fight only at DraftKings Sportsbook. You must be 21 years or older, New Jersey, Indiana, and Pennsylvania only. New customers only. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. And gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in Indiana, 1-800-9-WITH-IT. All right, let's get to the hockey story. One reference point this week, Thursday night, Toronto 5, Montreal 2. It's 4-0 before the game is a period old, so that's the score at the end of the first period. Toronto 4, Montreal nothing. And from there, the Habs tried to get back in the game physically. They removed the starting goaltender, Caden Primo, went with Jake Allen, who had struggled the night before against Ottawa, and suddenly that Habs run turns into a reversal. Bad loss in Ottawa, and the next night, bad loss in Toronto. Here's the only thing I can pull out of this game. It's 4-0. It becomes 4-1 after 40 minutes of play. And then early in the third, it becomes 4-2. Yes, Guy, we've been there many times before with the 4-1 lead that gets dissipated and evaporates. And so after it goes to 4-2, Galchenyuk takes a penalty. And you're thinking, yes, I've seen that movie before. But a director's cut, they did not play the movie. The Leafs actually smartened up, killed off the penalty, and started to take the game back. In fact, at 15:41, Austin Matthews scored his 40th of the season, and seconds before, he had almost scored his 40th, but then, of course, he atoned for that and got the goal. The reason I'm saying that is when Austin Matthews hopped over the boards and it was 4-2, you knew he was going to decide the issue, and he did. So 40 goals in 49 games, that is a 67-goal pace. So here are the positives from that game. 4-0 lead becomes 4-2, and then all of a sudden the Leafs win 5-2 on Austin Matthews on a 67-goal pace. These are things that didn't happen before, and these are some of the things that we're going to explore with our expert guests. Let's start with our first bit of analysis and welcome in David Alter from the Hockey News. Okay, David, let's go back to the Thursday night game against Montreal. Not much to analyze there with the 4-0 first period lead, but what is noteworthy is it was 4-1 going into the third, and there are plenty of reference points about misdeeds happening there, and even though it became 4-2, I thought they really did a nice job after it was 4-2.
Yeah, they were kind of pushing the pace there. There were a couple of opportunities for Montreal to kind of make a game of it, as you mentioned, but I think when you look at the scoring opportunities Toronto generated, Muzzin hitting a crossbar, Matthews almost converting before he actually did end up converting and putting the game away, it was clear who was the number one seed and who was the number four seed in this North Division. And I think a very encouraging thing for the Leafs as well is that this is their third or fourth last game of the season, and they're continuing to push the pace, even though they pretty much got the division locked up. So they're not resting on their laurels. They're trying to continue to play to a certain identity. And that bodes well for evaluating this team as if they're really different or not than previous years.
Yeah, I know. They're in a sort of a limbo area. They're like an inch away from clinching the division title. Having said that, they've got Montreal on Saturday night and then Ottawa and Winnipeg, which should be meaningless games. And you just, there's sort of a double-edged sword here. You want them to have a certain compete level, but you also want them to get through it healthy. Many teams have been there before. And sometimes it can be a disaster. It's precarious, isn't it?
It is, but I think they'll gladly take those risks, knowing they can happen everywhere, over complacency any day, because they really don't want to make excuses for themselves. And, you know, they're still going to ask their players, even in these next couple of regular season games, due to things that put you at risk, like block shots. Like, you got to get in there. You got to continue to play the way you are playing, because if you start to take your foot off the gas just a little bit, that can kind of creep back into your mindset when the game matters. It's not a quick, okay, flip the switch and I can turn it back on again. For a lot of players, it's not. It's repetition. It's continuing to put their foot down on the throttle. And look, the Leafs use their cap to load up on depth. So any sort of injuries, if there are any, from a mild standpoint, there's guys who can step in, and they've shown they can play to that spot, and there isn't a huge drop off. Obviously, if a star goes down, they may get hurt by that. But I mean, you have to take that risk. I think if you start telling players don't play this certain way, then I really do think that bad habits can creep in. So an opportunity cost for sure, but I think they have to continue to do that with the risks that are always out there.
Yeah, I think we can afford now to look back over the entire season because it's close to the end. And as I said when I talked to you the first time, the first question, I'm talking about that 4-1 lead, which was a disaster in the past. And so many times during the course of the year, we've seen them come up to that point that was, in the past, a disaster, and it doesn't happen again. They work through it. This team is not last year's Leafs or the year before, are they?
No, they aren't. And, you know, there's a lot of things and a lot of reasons as to why that's the case. I mean, when the Leafs went into the season with the division being how it is and the Canadian opponents, and a lot of people were looking at the standings and thinking, oh, well, this should be a breeze for them. You know, if they played the old way, maybe they do still win the division. But I think they use that opportunity to work on some things defensively and a lot of deficiencies in their game that maybe, you know, they wouldn't get the positive reinforcement with good results if they had to play teams like Boston and Tampa, do the right things but lose. The players may not necessarily want to buy into that if they're not seeing the results in the win column, right? So I think what's happened here is they had such an opportunity to work on a lot of their deficiencies, a lot of back checking, a lot of carrying the puck all the way and being aggressive on the forecheck, and doing it while you can make mistakes and maybe they don't burn you as badly as they might have in previous years. And guys came in more professional, more mature, and all the summation of all those parts set them up beautifully for where they are right now. So the playoffs are a different thing, but for at least two rounds, it's going to be familiar opponents. And there's no reason why they can't continue to play that style of game and continue to see the positive benefits from it.
What's the best part of this for you? For me, it's doing the games on TSN 1050. There were an area of concerns that we used to dwell on in the past. Now it's the power play, and that's the end of the concerns, really. Everything else has an answer to it, or an A, B, or a C. I mean, there's many options, and it works out. For me, it's just the power play. What is it for you?
From a concern standpoint, I think the goaltending is still a bit of a question mark. I mean, Jack Campbell has been great in the games that he's played. Frederik Andersen's been getting some conditioning time now, and it looks like they may try to get him in for a regular season game based on some cap maneuvering, but I still think that's a question. I think when you look at some of these other teams in the North Division, there are goaltenders that have a longer track record that, if healthy, can steal a few games. And it's going to be up to the Leafs to make sure they don't steal enough games. So I think that's a big question mark. Also, the playoff intensity is different. And I don't know how we're going to feel that when the crowds are still going to be empty. It's one of those things where, when you've been in a building for a playoff game, you can feel that energy from the crowd. Like, I remember one game against the Bruins. I think it was game six, when the Leafs were leading the Bruins in 2019, 3-2. And when the horn sounded for the end of the warm-up, you had the crowd cheering, which you never hear. Like, just little things like that get people amped up. That's my concern. There is, are the Leafs really going to feel like it's playoff time when you go into the building and you don't have the same kind of hype jump to the step? Like, what are going to be the things that the team does to hype themselves up that allow them to ratchet up the intensity? That's going to be a real question for me, because apart from home ice advantage for that last line change, it's not going to really have that same cachet this year, unfortunately, with everything that's gone on. So Those are a couple of concerns. But apart from that, like, I think as long as they continue to do what they do and not get caught up in the moment, they should cruise. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, they really took care of business this year. They answered a lot of question marks, didn't they?
Yeah, there really was the question of is the defense, the top pair defense, going to be much improved? Is TJ Brody really the answer to kind of stabilize that top pair? And really, like, I can't count on my hand how many times TJ Brody has made a mistake this season. He really hasn't been noticeable, and that's exactly what they wanted from him. And he's stabilized a pincher like Morgan Rielly, who can take chances, contribute offensively, and not get caught as much as maybe he had been in previous years. So I think that's a big one. I think the way they play physically was always a question, right? They tried to model Tampa this year by acquiring veterans that just have a little bit more of an aggressive attitude, that can really start throwing their body around when these games start to matter later in the season, and the template for what's called and what isn't called changes. And so I think they showed that in those games against Winnipeg, when they were starting to get called dirty. That was exactly what the Leafs needed. No one has ever accused the Leafs of being dirty. And for them to get that stigma, it was almost like Toronto was playing the Boston role of previous years. And I think that's a huge positive sign, because when it comes to the playoffs, there's going to be a lot that gets let go. And I think the Leafs have learned the psychology of that from the veterans that have instilled that in them, that they're going to know how to play the politics of the officiating that goes into a playoffs maybe than they have in better years.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Those two games in Winnipeg were interesting just because of how the Jets behaved, which I thought was out of character. And so they were concerned about the roughness of the Leafs. Hellebuyck had a bad game in game one, and I guess in game two he got burned on a couple of situations. But these were strengths. I mean, to me, Winnipeg was the best team rolling the four lines against the Leafs of anybody, and their goaltending was pretty good. And all of a sudden, major cracks in both issues.
Yeah, and it was really just kind of getting under the skin and getting into the grill of Hellebuyck. What do they say when a goaltender is hot? How do you try and get him off his game? Get in front of him. Start to aggravate him and get him under his skin. So I think they did a really good job of that, and kind of everyone went on tilt on the Jets right after. So it really is it's a mindset change. When the when the trade deadline ends, it seems to be like the players really turn on another gear because they know they're here for real. They don't have to worry about what moves may or may not happen. So they can just kind of, you know, get off to the races. And I think you saw that right after that Montreal game in early April, that the Leafs started to throw their body around more. They started to, you know, yap at the officials a bit more just to kind of, you know, make their point without going overboard so that they can kind of figure out the psychology of what's going on. And I think that that's such a big part of what the Leafs were missing in previous years. Remember a couple of years ago when Nazem Kadri got that suspension, the second one, and he actually got like a really vicious hit from Jake DeBrusk that wasn't called before. So it was a retaliation thing, but the Bruins played that politically perfect. They knew how to get under the Leafs' skin and make them do something dumb. And they won that series as a result of it, you know, taking out one of their more aggressive players. And so I think the Leafs have learned from that, that they've got to have, you know, guys who can kind of teach them the way. Like Joe Thornton knows exactly what to do in those situations to tell the skilled guys, hey, don't do it here. You know, jab them this time here. The refs won't call that. And then they'll get mad and they may retaliate and they'll call them. So that's really been the difference. And that's what Kyle Dubas keyed on, which was, you know, get these guys who can be a little bit more aggressive to complement the offense that you've always had. You needed the defense and you needed the aggression. And I think they improved on both of those fronts.
I don't think there's any argument that when the Leafs are totally healthy, it's an awesome roster. It's pretty darn good without some of the guys, but when it's healthy, it's totally, it's awesome. So let me ask you about a couple of injuries. The Bogosian one is on a longer track and the Anderson one is coming to an end, but I'm concerned about Foligno, Nash, and Hyman. What can you tell us about those three guys?
So Foligno skated before practice began on Friday. So that was a good sign. It doesn't seem to be anything long-term. I thought it was a bit of a concern for Foligno because I was in Montreal for that, not the game that he got hurt in. Well, I was in for both, but the first one, I noticed he was kind of stretching his hip area on the bench after he kind of fell under his own foot and didn't quite look the same. And then he was one of the three players that took the day off the next day for maintenance, which for a guy who's only played three games after having to sit out 2 weeks, a maintenance day is probably not something you wanted, but was probably needed because of how banged up he was. So when he got hurt just by skating to the Montreal net on a hard stop, it meant, you know what, this thing is lingering. Just get it right. Like, don't put yourself at risk. I know you want to pick up things because you haven't been here, but he's no good to them hurt. So the fact that he's skating and managing that, I think, bodes well that he'll probably be back in time for the playoffs, maybe gets one game in, depending on how the health is. Hyman and Riley are still in non-contact jerseys with a week to go, which suggests to me that they probably won't be back for the regular season. And with Anderson playing another full game with the Marlies and Sandin being held out of the lineup for the next game with what Sheldon Keefe calls cap maneuvering and anticipation, it's certainly looking like they may try to get Anderson a regular season game by taking Sandin off the roster, which they can, and then putting Hyman on the LTI, which would give them enough cap space to activate Anderson before the playoffs when the salary cap isn't a factor. So that's what it looks like right now in terms of the healthy guys. But they're both, the two non-contact guys are trending towards coming back. But I think they probably just wait until the regular season. They can go on conditioning stints with the Marlies as well. There's nothing to stop them from doing that. And many people have told me that those conditioning stints better serve players than they do goaltending, because the level of skill that a goalie is going to face in an NHL game is nothing compared to an NHL game, and Anderson really does need to get at least one if he's going to get any reps as an option for the playoffs.
Okay, David, I don't know if you have your seatbelt fastened, but we're going to play yes guy, no guy. You ready for this?
Yes.
Okay, guy. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, time now for the Leafs Guy official edition of Yes Guy, No Guy. Yes Guy, No Guy number one. The Leafs power play has the ability to cost the team in the playoffs.
Yes guy.
It's scary, isn't it?
I would normally say no, but there's going to be situations where there's been regular season games where it has cost them the difference. Like last game in Montreal, they had opportunities. They could have put Montreal away earlier, and they didn't. And I think special teams in general could be an issue for them.
Okay, yes guy, no guy number two. The goaltending scares you slightly.
Yes guy. I just think that with Anderson not 100% and the lack of reps combined with Campbell's ability to kind of not necessarily bounce back great if his confidence is shattered in any way, gives me a little bit of concern that momentum can flip on a switch if things go awry.
Yeah, I mean, you like Campbell, but, you know, if he had to play seven games in a row in a playoff series, I'm not sold on that part, are you?
No, I mean, I think he could. Like, there's been many times where our goalies who just never really seem to realize it pick up their game in the playoffs once given an opportunity. And even though they've had no past track record, they've lived in the moment. And if there's one thing Campbell's done this season is he's been able to live in the moment and rattle off wins. So it's just the whole regression to the mean. Has he used it up too early or does he have another one left in him? So that still remains to be seen.
Okay, yes guy, no guy. The bottom six forwards of the Leafs team are actually a strength of the team.
Yes guy. I think that there's going to be so much changing around there. And a lot of times you don't even know who the third or fourth line is because of players that have mixed in and around. Like Thornton was a third liner, but not really a third liner because he's playing on the fourth line, but he's also playing with Spezza and with Brooks, and sometimes Kerfoot's been in there. That the third line and the fourth line are so interchangeable that there really are two third lines, which is a huge luxury for them. So yes, guy, for them.
Okay, final yes, guy, no guy of this particular podcast. Yes, guy, no guy. The 5-6 pairing on the blue line without Bogosian bothers you a bit.
No, guy. I think Sandin has stepped in really well in that spot. I mean, having Bogosian's playoff experience will definitely help, but I think he's already improved that back end so much by his presence throughout the regular season. He seems to have improved Dermott's game a lot. I think there's guys that they've brought in like Ben Hutton who can play in that spot too and be the aggressor, but also can contribute offensively. That I don't think that it's as much of a concern. And also I've gone three yes guys as well, so it would have been hard to do the sweep. So I think it's a no guy just in that spot, even though Bogosian has been a huge part of the team this season.
Great, David. Thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
And down the hall we go, and we'll open the door to the Leafs guy time tunnel. We go back into the 80s, Gary Lehman. Okay, Gary, let's go way back to 1982. You're drafted in the second round, and you're a defenseman in junior hockey. Much like later on, Wendell was a defenseman. You didn't have much trouble becoming a forward, did you?
Well, I actually did. I mean, it took 3 years for them to decide I was going to be a forward, but... 1982, I was still in Regina playing with the Pats. And the day I was drafted, I had my jaw wired shut from a body check that I took in the semifinals. I had to listen to the draft on the radio.
Huh.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. It was fun for me to be drafted back to my hometown. I had left when I was 15 years old to go to Notre Dame in Saskatchewan. Played 2 years midget there, and then that was my third. So my draft year was my third year away from home. So I was actually ready to go home. You know, you lose touch with your family and friends. So for me, I didn't really understand the dysfunction that the Maple Leafs were at that time. I was just happy to be drafted to the blue and white.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is a lot of dysfunction then. Those are not the great years, that's for sure. Those are struggling years for the Leafs from top to bottom, literally. So when you step into that as a rookie, I mean, how do you get through that? I mean, they had to rely on some veterans there, but there's constant change and upheaval, and it was just a bad time, wasn't it?
Yeah, like you said, there was a ton of change. You know, we had ownership that probably the game had passed by. Mr. Ballard was, or Harold, was he was older, and of course we all know, you know, he was afflicted with degenerative brain disease, and you know, I think maybe he should have stepped aside a little bit earlier, and it caused probably a lot of chaos where he was still hiring both the GM and the coach, and not really delegating, the position of a general manager to be able to hire his own coach. And, you know, we always saw the conflict. And so that created a culture where, you know, as a young guy, you look to the older players, and the older players learn that they probably need to just, you know, take care of themselves and try and get through this storm. So as a young guy, you know, looking for that leadership, you know, there were guys, but as a whole, it was a mess.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty obvious that way. It was volatile, is the way I used to describe it. And then there's, you know, the Mr. Ballard situation. And then there's, you know, there's this, after he dies, there's this struggle to take over, which goes on for a number of years. And that didn't help the franchise either. Although everybody meant well, it's just, if the top is not stable, the rest can't be either.
Oh, exactly. Just like in any business, and so with all the changes, there's never a plan. And when there's no plan, there's you going into drafts and whatnot, you just maybe draft the best player, or I had four general managers in my time in Toronto, so I'm pretty sure that the plan didn't get passed on to the next guy. And also there was never and I challenge anybody that either played, in the 80s, to say that there was a game plan, because there was never a game plan. We never learned anything. We got yelled at, we got screamed at, we got skated. And then, some games our talent would win us games, but we were just lost in our own end. And then when, we had the opportunity to just play, I guess, offensive, you saw the talent, but we needed to learn how to play defense to challenge challenge the good teams for any type of shot at winning.
Yeah, so just for everybody's understanding, we're talking about a time when there was a head coach and an assistant coach. Nobody was even doing video, were they?
Well, there actually was. There was some video. Video was new. There was a lot of things that were new. I remember the stat sheet coming down from Stan Abodiak the first time that John Brophy brought it into the dressing room. And, there were things that were changing. That was a real interesting time, because I had showed up right at the end of kind of old time hockey, old school hockey. And that's when, the shift was to probably play with, more talent rather than toughness, I guess, or goonery, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But, again, we had an owner that just defied that by saying, I'm never going to have a Russian on my team, and they were as highly skilled as anybody in the world. And so that would maybe put you at a disadvantage, maybe, depending on who it was that you would have ended up getting. But we ended up, getting some talented European guys and whatnot. And it was a kind of a tough time to justify it when other teams were still trying to play the old style. So, once in a while you didn't have enough, physical guys in your lineup, and you get pushed around a little bit, and then you have to go to the minors to, pull up some guys to, send a message. And it was just a mess.
It's kind of an ad lib situation. As I was talking about the video, that I remembered that my show Sportsline, you know, this was when we started that show, that this was the start of satellites. So, you know, it was a highlight show because we could see the games, which nobody else could. Other TV stations could, but the individual couldn't. And so we would have Dan Maloney or John Brophy come up and watch games from other teams to scout, because the Gardens did not have a satellite dish on it at that time, shortly after they got one. But that's how sort of haphazard the whole system was at the time. Everything was just starting to get to where we are now.
Yeah. And now they've got, you know, they've got guys that are in the video room like all day long. Those poor guys are, it's like a sweat box, I guess, in there. And analytics and all this stuff entering all the major leagues, it's the polar opposite of what we had experienced. And so, you know, it was important to watch the older guys and to learn from the older guys. And we had Borja Salming there, who was great with the guy. He was, you know, his nickname was King, and it was for a reason. But Borja, even though we all knew that he was the leader, we also knew that he didn't wear the C, and he didn't wear it for a reason, because there was still going to be the conflict that he didn't want. He wasn't Borja. He yeah. wasn't a very confrontational person. And so he didn't want that burden of having to deal with management and ownership. So, you know, it was a real tough time to navigate, no matter who you were in the organization. You know, you always had to wonder what was next, because there was always change.
Yeah, and, you know, to sort of round out the C, I mean, you know, I was around when Daryl Sittler was removed. And when he departed, and that was a tough day for the franchise when he got traded to Philadelphia. And really, anybody who wore the C for a number of years was sort of had a target on their back. It was a tough position to fill, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, like, what organization gets rid of a Daryl Sittler, Dave Keon? You don't let these guys walk. I mean, they're guys that had put, you know, blood, sweat. They put their heart into everything that they did for that team. Lanny McDonald, you know, you just don't give these guys away. I don't care how old they are. You do the right thing. You build a culture, and you show the young players that are coming next what to be like. You know, what we expect from you, what we want from you, and these are the guys that paved the way, and, you know, respect that and respect that that's how we're going to be. But it was a little divided, I'd say, depending on who was in control.
Yeah. I still go back to the word I said, volatile. Even as a member of the media, you didn't really know what was going to happen. But if there were a collection of losses, or there was a stumble in the standings, you know that there was potential for anything, really. It was so volatile that you didn't know what would happen, but you knew something would. And you just sort of crossed your fingers that it would be for the benefit of the franchise. And a lot of times it wasn't, was it?
Oh, no. Like I said, there was no plan. They'd make kind of knee jerk reactions. You know, if one coach thought that we needed, you know, more toughness, we'd trade Russ Cardinal for John Cordick. And, you know, that sets you back. Russ was a high draft pick, you know, and it's tough to get high draft picks. And why would you want to do that? Why would you, and why would you want to trade Vinny Damfus, Luke Richardson, Scott,
Thornton.
Yeah. Scotty Thornton.
Yeah.
Which were all young guys, high draft picks, for, you know, a goalie that was great. He had what, 3 or 4 more years left. Glenn Anderson, who was probably on the downside of his career. He could still contribute for sure, but there's a reason why the Edmonton Oilers traded Wayne Gretzky and we're trading Grant Fuhr and we're trading Glenn Anderson. And we scooped them up and we gave away 59 years of service. Damphus Richardson played 20 years pro, and you know, 90% of that was after the trade. And same with Scotty Thornton, he played 18 years pro. So, you know, talk about setting an organization back. You know, I think they would have been in Toronto for as long as they wanted to be. And, you know, the guys that came this way were old and you know, close to retirement.
Well, look, you know, I don't know what it was like on the inside. It's different. Like, I'm on the outside, but I was at the Gardens. I would go down to training camp because I wanted to see the draft picks, the draft at that point. You know, Vinny Damphus, these are televised draft events, and I would go to the draft. And I can still remember the first time Vinny Damphus skated as a Maple Leaf. I can't remember who it was, but somebody came up to me and said, he's no good. I said, he just got out on the ice. How do you know that? But that was the negativity in the air. There was just looking for somebody to whip, and I thought, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, everybody's an expert in Toronto, you know. And there's, you know what, along with that, though, there's passion. There's, you know, there's care, there's passion, but it seems like everybody wants to be, you know, that guy that knows everything.
Oh, yeah. And
if there's no plan, how are you going to know? Like, who's going to even survive this year? It was just so chaotic and just dysfunctional and but anyhow, you had to navigate through it. You had to adapt to the new coach, in which I had eight or nine, you know, during my time, 8.5 years in Toronto, I had 8 or 9. I finally had enough. I wanted, like I said at the beginning, I'd been away from home when I was young, and I wanted to be one of the guys that helped rebuild this, because I grew up playing all kinds of sports and winning, and I wanted, that's what I wanted. I didn't give a crap about my stats. I didn't give a crap about anything but winning. And, you know, we had, you know, coaches like Dan Maloney and John Brophy early in my career, and I liked them because they wanted to win.
Yeah.
You know, and so you hope that you're going to learn, you hope that you're going to progress, and you hope that things are going to, you know, you're going to grow, not just as an individual, but, you know, as a team, because you can tell right away how good a team is. And, you know, with all the changes, it didn't happen. You know, it just didn't happen because the game had passed these guys by. They were great guys. They were, you know, but they were a certain type of guy and player, you know, they were,
yep.
They weren't guys that played my kind of game. You know, they were guys that were fighters. Like Dan Maloney was as tough as they came, and Brof, you know, himself, he was tough and he'd do anything out there, you know?
Yep.
So they liked, like I had a good rapport with them because they knew I wanted to win, and I was a guy that really wasn't, I wasn't you know, designed to fight. I was designed to compete like crazy, and that's why I decided if I wanted to stick around, I had to fight, because the culture was you have to show that you're willing to. And you know, that's what counts. You got to do that. But you know, I kind of wish that I stayed as a defenseman. I wanted to play defense. I was having success in junior on defense, and my kind of game was sort of like a center half in soccer, where you kind of control the game, and that's what it was like for me in junior hockey, and that's what it was like my second year midget playing, my first year of defense. And anyhow, they drafted me, you know, as a quarterback for the power play, is basically how they put it. And I was fine with that. I was great with that because I felt like I could control a game. So, but I think what happens is they look at what is happening to the guys before. I came along right after they had drafted Bob McGill, Fred Buymistruk, Jimmy Benning, and they had thrown them into the fire.
Yeah.
And I think they decided with me that they weren't going to do that. They don't want to ruin another one, I guess, is kind of how they put it. So I remember being told that I'm going to dress for 50 games, which I did my first 3 years. And the rest of the games, we want you to go to the press box and watch. That's what I was told to watch. And so, okay, I'm up there eating popcorn with you guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, and watching, and it's like, oh, pretty good view up here. Why didn't he do that? Why didn't he do that? And it's like, okay, you know, and then you get your chance and you know, you listen to the hype, you know, here's your chance.
Yeah.
So get out there and go as hard as you can.
Well, I mean, you did adjust to being a forward. You had 51 goals. That had to feel good.
Yeah, I produced when I played. I mean, you play me, I'm gonna produce. You put me on the fourth line, I'm not gonna give you very much, you know.
Yeah,
it's just the way it was, and but for me it was a little different because I didn't know what position I was gonna be. So when I did play, I was playing both positions on the go. So for me it was on the job training.
It's just, it's kind of laughable now, but I mean, with you and Wendell, if they kept you both on the blue line, you wonder how that would have turned out.
Yeah. I certainly wanted to stay on the blue line. I think I would have gave them something that they probably didn't have at the time. You know, I could skate, I could see the ice, pass the puck. I love to move the puck. I mean, yeah, I might have scored some goals, but I love to move the puck because I love to be creative. So when I moved the puck, I would just either stay where I was because everybody follows the puck and I'm now open, so give it back, or, you know, find the open ice. And, you know, I think that's what good creative players do. Guys that score, guys that are playmakers, they know where the open ice is to get the pass. And do something with it. So, I wish I had stayed as a defenseman, but I was ready to play any position my third year. And John Brophy came up to me in training camp, and he said, if I make you a forward, can get me 20 goals. I said, if you play me. So we put Russ and Wendell and myself together, formed the Hound line. And, you know, I think we had a little bit of energy because we were young and, you know, Wendell's smashing everything out there. And Russ was quick and exciting, you know. If we had somebody maybe to teach us how to play defense, we might still be playing together.
Well, I mean, you know, as it worked out, that forward line had all the elements that you would expect out of a very, very good forward line. It had everything.
Yeah, everything except what do we do in our own end? You know, you could tell that there was just a lack of communication, just a lack of knowledge of, like, what is your job in your own end. And, you know, from midget hockey, I learned how important one-on-one hockey was, and how important it was going to be down the road. And so, you know, you just made sure that you didn't get beat one-on-one in your own end, and that's all you basically knew. You know, and then there's the obvious. If there's a breakdown, you have to risk leaving your point man as a winger and help down low, you know. And but there was never any type of plan, any type of system.
No so breakout system. Yeah.
And you can see it now. Like, you can watch the Leafs now and you go, they're very, very well coached. They really are very well coached. The structure, all the guys are getting, they're getting the message. You know, I think Nylander missing the meeting, you know, a little while ago. I think that was more of a message of, okay, you're missing some assignments also. So we're going to, you know, and look what happens when, you know, when the coach does the right thing, he wakes a guy up and it's however you want to deliver it, deliver it. And he's being responsible now. So, that's good coaching. That's smart, direction for a guy that's still learning. He's still learning. Like, trust me, all the guys are still learning because they're now on a new team. Even the guys that have won a cup, you got your Bogosian and Campbell and is there another guy?
I think maybe that's it. Who did I miss?
See, these guys have learned, you know, when they won. Muzzin. Oh, Muzzin, right. Yeah, these guys, they learned how to win.
Yeah.
When they won, right?
Yeah.
I got the opportunity when I went to Montreal and I watched guys like Guy Carbonneau who had already won before. And wow, did I ever learn a lot? And they taught you how to win at that level. And that's the difference. That would have been the difference between playing for Toronto back then and Montreal back then. You know, we had Serge Savard was our GM and he was very interactive with the guys. And you could always see him conversing positively with Jacques Lemaire, the coach. And we also had in the background Jacques Lemaire. And, you know, these are guys that you learn how to win from because you're good enough as an amateur to make your team win. But now you're playing in a league where every team's filled with those guys. So now it's a new, you know, it's a new level. So,
well, yeah, that's I mean, if you've got a resource like Jacques Lemaire and Serge Savard, I mean, that is impressive.
It really is. And you know, Guy Carbonneau is, I think, the most underrated offensive guy. You know, he was so great defensively, positionally defensively.
Yeah.
But his offense is under the radar. He was very, very, very skilled and very good offensively. But, you know, he learned this stuff from Bob Gainey, who probably learned it from Jacques Lemaire and so on. And that's what you need. You need to build, you know, a culture in a winning way. And they had it.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but this Leafs team is very, very good. The power play is it's tough. It's a tough view. What's the missing link there?
Well, I think teams have probably figured out what they want to do, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just like anything. It's like how the game's evolved. You know, the game got faster. So and with the sticks now, guys can shoot quicker. So how do you defend against that? Right. You can score from the blue line with a flick shot because the sticks are so good. So you have to learn to play against that. So how do you do that? You clog up the middle of the ice, you close the gaps. And so it's the same thing on a power play. You see a successful power play and, you know, with video, you look at it and you go, okay, what are these guys doing? You know, they want to get this guy the puck or this guy's the engine or, you know, so you learn to defend against that. And they still haven't done that. I'm shocked that they still haven't figured out Matthews and Marner and maybe that'll be different in the playoffs where, you know, you probably need to play a little bit more physical with those guys, even when you're killing a penalty. But so, you know, you can tell that they work a lot on their power play. They have in the past, they've got set plays. They have really good plays. They move the puck brilliantly, as good as any team I've seen. But you remember that they've done this for a couple of years now and the teams now know what they're going to do. So they can learn to defend against that, because that's, you know, that's going to be the difference. So, and then it'll be interesting to see in the playoffs whether they step it up, whether they can step the power play up or not, because the game's going to be a little bit different, right? So, yeah, I would say that they've just learned to defend against them being so dominating against, you know, you have to do something against something that's that good.
Yeah, it's a final thought. I mean, when you watch a game now and you see the guy go back to the bench and he goes and gets the tablet and watches the play that just happened, that is great, isn't it?
yeah, I can't believe it. Like, you know, we weren't allowed to like look around, never mind, you know, look at an iPad or whatever on a bench. But yeah, it does show you how advanced systems are, and you know, most of the time you shouldn't have to look at it. You should know exactly what happened. But those are the guys you want out there, I think, the guys that don't need to look at the tablet.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the tablet, it's like maybe, you know, emphasis on something you did wrong, obviously. But
yeah.
To have that technology is unbelievable. The technology all around is amazing. Like I said, the sticks have made the game. I believe the sticks have made the game as fast as it is now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, because you can do just so much more with them. You can shoot way better. Getting a dozen sticks from the manufacturer, they're all going to be identical. Whereas in our day, we had the torches and the rasps going, the different weights. It was, the dies were a little bit archaic back in the 80s, but one of my trainers told me I went through 43 dozen sticks one year.
Oh.
And this is when I was, you know, one of the go-to guys. So I didn't give a crap if I sent the sticks back. So I didn't go through them playing, but I sent, that's how many I had sent to me. I would get probably between 1 and 4 in each dozen that I thought were okay.
Wow.
And the rest would go to Doug Laurie Sports.
Wow. I was going to say, that's a lot of tomato plants, because they were wood. You could just cut them off and use them for steaks.
right. Lots of tomatoes around.
That's crazy. Yeah. Gary, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good chat with you, Jim.
Last minute of play in this podcast.
And there is the time warning from our PA announcer, Mike Ross. Thank you very much, Rossi. You're doing a fine job. Now, time for the Yes Guy Awards, and some of this is repetitive, but I don't think you can blame me. Auston Matthews, 40 goals in 49 games, 67-goal pace on a regular season. That is an emphatic. Can I hear it? Yes, Guy! Mitch Marner is 19th in the season. This goal happens in the first period. He dipsy-doodled through everybody. Oh, Mitch Marner is a Yes Guy. By the way, he has 47 assists. The power play, Guy. This is something. I don't know what the solution is here, but it's a problem. They had a 5-on-3. This is at the end of the game. They're already up, 5-2? And this is extra time. This is bonus time, and they didn't do anything with it. Oh, no, Guy. And the final Yes Guy Award goes to 4-0 Leafs lead. They win 5-2. Look, in the past, last year, the year before that, that 4-0 lead dissipates. It is disaster. On Thursday night, it was a 5-2 win. That is an emphatic, a relieved Yes Guy. Hope you enjoyed episode 34 of Leafs Guy, and hope you come back for episode 35 on Tuesday.